Welcome to the Turkey Hunter Podcast, the original all turkey, all the time podcast with your co-hosts Andy Galliano and Cameron Weddington.
In our weekly podcast, we're going to bring you some wild turkey calling tips like this.
From there, we're going to go into she's aggravated. There's another hen that's challenged her, or she's challenging another hen. She's going to cut an excited yelp.
Advice from old pro turkey hunters like this.
The turkeys typically don't like, I think, more times than not, to travel in an easterly direction into the sun first thing in the morning, especially after he gets up. It's a blinding thing. It's just like you. It's hard for you to see into the sun. Mm-hmm. So if I have a choice, I'm going to try to make it so that I'm going to be on the west side in the morning, east side in the afternoon of a turkey.
Exciting live hunts like this.
Holy crap, they're coming. Holy cow.
Then we're going to teach you how to cook your bird with advice such as this.
With some fresh rosemary and garlic, and then cool that off and spread that along the inside of that butterflied turkey breast that we've seasoned on both sides.
Wildlife management tips for your property, especially with turkeys like this.
If you look at the type of habitats that turkeys need for nesting and brooding, that tends to be habitat that can be managed more successfully with growing season fire than with dormant season fire.
And hopefully along the way, we'll get plenty of these.
Well, on November the 28th of 1953, I was hatched. When I popped out of my mom and the baby doctor spanked me on the bottom, I went, oh, and I've been doing it ever since.
I like that.
Thank you for tuning in, and now for this week's show.
Hello, and welcome back to this week's episode of the Turkey Hunter Podcast. You are listening to episode number 481. Yeah, it's a little bit early for it, but you're listening to episode number 481, Wild Turkey Research Findings and Hope for Change in Season Dates. And I am your co-host and the guy who spent too much time out of the woods this past week due to weather and his wife touching his alarm clock.
What a trick that is to pull on a man.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I'm your co-host and I'm the guy who is sick of stray dogs.
Oh, gosh. Let me hear it.
Man, so I sent you the video earlier in the year, you know, a couple weeks ago, of the two dogs that almost caught my gobbler. Did I send you that?
Yeah.
And anyway, I had any, you know, I bought a small farm myself. It's my own little piece of heaven, and had the turkeys on it. The gobbler was there. Two dogs literally almost catch this turkey, like a German Shepherd and another mutt, are right on his heels within 2 yards of him when he flies in front of my camera. Well, I hadn't had turkeys there for 10 days, rightfully so. They're getting chased by dogs. And yesterday afternoon, I finally get some turkeys on camera, and I noticed some of them flying. And I was like, huh, they're flying up awfully early. Request a video. It comes in. Two freaking dogs chasing them again. And, man, I swear, these stupid dogs. And it's like, there's like 20 different dogs out there. They're just freaking everywhere.
So it's not two dogs.
Oh, there's more than two. These were two different ones, I think, that I had on video yesterday. And then I actually had a hunt screwed up by a pack of like eight dogs this past week as well, where I sat down to a turkey. I was less than 100 yards from him on the ground. It was about to be on. He's gobbling on his own. And before I even made a call, this pack of dogs rambushed him. Anyway, I'm sick of dogs, man. Sick of dogs.
Yeah. So, yeah, I can see that.
Yes, I think it's a real problem. I mean, I think it was down in Florida, maybe Marcus Lashley or one of the studies done there, like a lot of nests were lost because of dogs.
Yes. Yeah.
And I can't imagine. I mean, I don't know how a hen would ever nest on my property without being chased off the nest or killed on the nest by dogs, because they're constantly roaming through there. And I mean, dogs have pretty good sense of smell.
Yeah, your Labrador is not that far removed from coyote.
Yeah. Anyway, I think they're a real problem. So those dogs probably should not come near me if I hunt there.
House cats are the same thing. They will wear their pults out.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know what the solution is there. I don't know if I can get the pound to come stake out my property or what, get rid of these jokers. But they're wild looking dogs. They're not from the neighboring homes around there or something like that, I don't think.
Yeah. I don't know what to tell you about all that other than maybe call your local warden and see what your warden, if he or she knows of any feral dogs. And, well, you know, gotten any reports of any feral dogs in the area? Because if you can tie them to, or, you know, point them to one of your neighbors, then I'm not saying the conversation ever goes over all that well, but at least it's worth a conversation.
Yeah.
Please keep your dogs up at least for the next 2 months as much as you can, because turkeys are nesting and having babies and it's just smart.
Yeah. Well, there's that.
Do not ever threaten, whether you would actually do something to the dogs or you would never do something to the dogs. Doesn't matter. Do not threaten the dogs. I've heard too many stories of that going wrong.
Yeah.
Whether the person in question did something, the person threatening did something to the dogs or not, doesn't matter.
Hmm.
That dog could get hit by a car on the highway, and guess who's going to be getting a knock on the door?
Interesting.
So, well, that's my 2 cents.
Yeah, I may go home and punch my lab in the face just to make me feel better.
Oh, so
that is a joke. Please do not send the animal abuse hotline anything. Weddington. I would never hurt my dog.
@gmail.com. Cameron.Weddington@gmail.com. So we'll start this show over. Hello and welcome back to this week's episode of Punch Your Dog in the Nose podcast.
Yeah. Well, we're here early, so everybody, we're releasing the show early. This is this week's show, the week of the 15th through the 19th. This is the show, so don't expect another one. But we wanted to release this early for multiple reasons. A, this is very timely and pertinent information for the state of Tennessee, so we want to report on this prior to the commission voting on the 18th and 19th for next year's season dates in Tennessee. So it's timely for that. We want our public to be informed, and this podcast is full of information on what these guys have found and what their recommendations are for future seasons in Tennessee. And secondly, Andy and I are both leaving and going on trips. So it actually works out really nice to go ahead and get this thing out there, and we can go have fun and turkey hunt and not have to worry about it.
Yeah. And what Cameron said is right. It's great for anyone in Tennessee to have this content prior to the vote that's going to be taking place, but also for those of you who hunt Tennessee regularly, hey, your voice needs to be heard as well.
And those in other states, South Carolina, for instance, or a ton of states are looking at season delays. That's a huge part of the topic we're covering today, and whether or not that works. And you need to listen to this. These guys just studied it for 7 years, so I would say they're qualified to make an opinion on the matter.
Yes, this is going to apply to your turkeys, whether you're in New York State, Washington State, Texas State, or Tennessee State. So it's great information, really is interesting. You guys are going to enjoy the interview, and we have with us today Dr. David Bueller with UT, and we have with us Dr. Craig Harper with UT as well. And I was fortunate enough to watch the presentation they did at the NWTF convention in Nashville back in February and actually recorded it.
You thought?
Yeah, I did record it. It just did not cord because of the new microphone. But I think this, what we did was better. This interview is better because Cameron and I are able to ask questions. Cameron has question after question after question. I let him run with this thing because he had a million questions to ask. And so anyway, do listen in closely. And if something like this is being considered in your state, hey, feel free to forward this show to anyone on the Conservation Advisory Board or on the Department of Natural Resources or Wildlife Resources or Game and Fish or whatever's called in your state. Feel free to forward this episode to them along with your opinions of what you would like to see done in your state. So with that said, what do you think? You want to get on with experts and
let's remind everybody that in the show notes you can find two links. One is to our shop where you can get some merchandise to support the Turkey Hunter podcast. And in that shop, you also will see three different diaphragm turkey calls, getting rave reviews about those. They work, and I think you'll like the way they're built. So check those out. And then the other link is our Patreon account, where we just posted 4 hours of bonus content, where Andy and I rode around with two students who are studying wild turkeys, and it was an incredible experience. And then we also have bonus content weekly from our shows that we clip out portions of the audio and put only in there for our Patreon members. So go check Patreon out and our shop. And with that said, let's talk to Dr. Harper and Dr. Bueller about turkey seasons and bag limits and what they think we need to be doing.
See you guys on the other side.
Hey, everybody. We're excited to bring on the show with us this evening Dr. Craig Harper and Dr. David Bueller out of the University of Tennessee. And these two guys just headed up a, I believe, 7-year study of wild turkeys here in Tennessee, and mostly focusing in southern middle Tennessee with several different questions and answers, you know, figured out through the study so far. And so we wanted to get them on the show before next week, or it will, when this airs this week, when the commission will be voting for season setting dates and bag limits for the future of turkey hunting in Tennessee. And we wanted to get them on and see if we could learn some stuff about their study and Tennessee turkeys and kind of what they think about, you know, how the season should be structured. So how are you guys doing this evening?
I'm doing great.
Well, good. Y'all aren't ready to go turkey hunting, are you?
At this very moment, Cameron, at this very moment, I'm sitting in my home office looking out the window at a gobbler feeding in the woodland behind my house right now.
If you don't
right send, now, at this moment.
Send an Onyx pin, it didn't happen.
So, Craig, is that bird feeding up so he can hide starting on Saturday?
Yeah, he's feeding actively right now. Of course, he's already bred, and so he's primarily feeding at this point.
Have you asked him if he's gobbled out?
I've heard him a few times. He's not gobbled out, but he's been getting after it.
Good deal. Well, it sounds like you won't have to go far to find one Saturday morning, I don't think.
Well, I hope not, but you know, there's always this thing called neighbors, and neighbors have this stuff called corn that they throw out all over the ground, and that can certainly be a limiting factor.
And you ain't kidding. I have heard of more baiting this year in Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, states that are open, than like ever, by like tenfold. I think everybody baits turkeys right now.
It's hideous. I know Will Goolsby has done some work looking at this, and he and Marcus have talked about it a time or two on their podcast and, you know, in person. And what they found is the amount of, quote, feed that is placed on the landscape is absolutely staggering. And I figured we would get into some of this, but, you know, there's a push now of, you know, how we need to ban certain decoys and reaping and all this. And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that, but I can tell you one thing. Corn kills a lot more birds than any decoy.
Man, you probably are not kidding.
And I'm not talking about from a disease point of view, but from putting it out there and hunting over it. It's hard to kill a gobbler that doesn't have corn in his crop, at least anywhere around here, I can tell you. And of course, I do not place corn out for turkeys.
Yeah. I mean, I've killed several on public land, you know, maybe near a private border, something like that. And corn and Milo, it's almost like guaranteed in the crop.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy. But, well, let's talk about Tennessee. I guess, you know, there's a lot of states who I would say at least 2 years ago, everyone was very concerned about turkeys in the Southeast. A lot of people still are. And, you know, in my just personal experience, I feel like most of the Southeast has experienced a little bit of an increase in turkeys the past 2 years from where we were, which still was, you know, hopefully rock bottom. But do we have any problems with turkey populations statewide in Tennessee?
Well, I can jump in.
I'll let Dave take the first crack at that.
Yeah, so, you know, Tennessee is blessed to have a really good statewide turkey population with excellent turkey hunting. And this has been the case for the last, you know, 20 years. We've been one of the best states in the country, and we still continue to kill about 30,000 birds plus a year. So even though there's a lot of concern about what the population might be doing, we were blessed to have an abundance of turkeys, and we still have, in many parts of the state, very good turkey populations. So we're in a really good position compared to some of these other states because we're seeing declines in the turkey population, and, you know, that is somewhat concerning, but we're starting at a really high level to begin with. And so when we decline from that level, we're still in pretty good shape compared to a bunch of other states that, you know, have much, much worse situations.
Yeah, I
completely agree. And I think back when I came to Tennessee in 1998, when I began work at UT. And of course, I'm the extension wildlife specialist. And so I travel around all the time. And I remember back in the late 90s when you could go into some areas in South Middle Tennessee and literally see a winter flock of 1,000 birds. I mean, it is unbelievable. And you will not see that. You will not see that anywhere now, especially not in that area of Tennessee. But, you know, at the same time, you have to kind of wonder how sustainable is that? You know, that was at the peak when the population was really increasing exponentially after all of the introductions, and turkey populations obviously were responding and doing great, but we don't see numbers like that anymore. And that is bothersome, and it's bothersome to a lot of people. And they certainly have seen decline on their property. And Dave mentioned something that I think is very important. We're still seeing the annual harvest rate, you know, somewhere around 30 to 35,000 birds on average. But when you talk to people, they're not seeing as many birds on their property. They may still be killing as many, but they're not necessarily seeing as many. And that's something to really take into consideration.
Yeah. So harvest has remained stable. I understand that, you know, that's pretty easy metric to track, but at least in my opinion, and Andy would probably agree with me, turkey hunting seems to be almost at all-time highs in popularity. And a lot more people are crossing state borders to turkey hunt than they used to, at least in my opinion. And I have no data to back that up, but I'd be kind of shocked if that's not two very true statements. So is turkey harvest staying above 30,000 here due to, you know, turkeys staying at the same population level, or because they're being hunted harder and we're killing just as many because effort's gone up?
Yeah, you know, we've been tracking through our hunter surveys, hunter effort and hunter success. And, you know, the interesting thing is those southern middle Tennessee counties, you know, they're still really good places to hunt. But based on our surveys, only 50% of the hunters are successful in getting a bird down there, which, you know, is kind of shocking, really, when you consider how good it used to be down there. But, and on top of that, it's taking, we asked them how many hours do they hunt and how many trips do they take, but it's taking them somewhere between 10 to 12 trips of 3 to 4 hours each trip to kill a bird. So you can kill a bird down there, you know, every year if you want, but half the hunters are not successful. And to me, that just shows that the number of gobblers that are out there now has to be much lower than it was, you know, 10, 15 years ago, because otherwise you'd see much greater success rates.
Yeah. I mean, that almost seems like it has to be the case. Like, I mean, I just know, I feel like most every turkey is getting hunted these days, whether they have permission to be hunted or not. And it seems like, yeah, we don't have as many birds as we had. And, harvest is a good metric to track, but I don't know that that should be like how we base our population models. I would assume y'all would agree with that.
Yeah, and, you know, that's exactly right, that, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into harvest, as you mentioned. But the population itself, it's a little more difficult to really get a handle on how that population is doing unless you go out intentionally and start collecting data. And that was really the basis for our project, because in those South Middle Tennessee counties, the hunters and the elected officials, the landowners, and TWRA all thought there had been a significant decline, but harvest was still, you know, holding up there. And so they contracted with Craig and myself and the University of Tennessee to come in and do this study to actually collect the data on populations and vital rates to understand what's, you know, what's really going on. And when you actually get all the numbers and start running them through population models and other analyses, then you can kind of understand what's really going on with that population today, and give you a hint about where it might be headed in the future as well.
So do y'all want to kind of explain the, like a brief explanation of what the study entailed? Because I've read it, but a lot of our listeners may not know about it. You know, what were y'all studying and where? You know, it was four control counties and two control counties and four where there was a treatment. Is that correct?
Yeah, you want to jump in, Craig?
As Dave mentioned, we worked actually in five counties.
Okay.
And three of the counties, in all five counties, we collected data for 4 years on all of the vital rates and, of course, movements, habitat use, et cetera. And we did this primarily with hens, but we also radio tracked a few hundred gobblers. But we primarily did this with hens because that was the focus of the study, to look at productivity. And so we looked at productivity for 4 years. And then in 2020, you know, there was a thought that we may be opening the season too early, that we may be killing dominant gobblers before they have had an opportunity to breed, or at least to breed most of the hens. And also, you know, when you harvest a dominant gobbler, you are disturbing the hierarchy of the birds. And of course, there was a thought that that disturbance to the hierarchy could be disturbing the reproductive pattern, and thus you may be delaying reproduction from then, and all of that could be contributing to lower productivity. And so the Fish and Wildlife Commission with Tennessee, the commissioners, they voted to implement an experimental 2-week delay in the three southernmost counties. And might I say, you know, it took a lot of guts to do that. And I sincerely applaud them for putting the money and the effort all forward to enable us to look at that. It was, a spectacular opportunity, because we had 4 years of what we would call pre-treatment data. And then the delay was implemented for 2 years in 21 and 2022 in those three counties, but not in the two adjacent northern counties that had not experienced declines in harvest. And so what that did was set up a before after control impact design, where we had 4 years of pre-treatment data in all five counties, and then 2 years of treatment data in three of the counties, and the other two counties did not receive treatment. And so we were able to compare the vital rates that Dave will explain, and what impact delay in the season had on reproduction.
Yeah, and then, you know, last year they delayed the season statewide 2 weeks. So I assume, did y'all continue gathering data last year as well?
Yes.
So we essentially have three years of data on 2-week delay, one statewide and 2 years on just those counties. And then you have three years of data on all of them prior to anything?
Yeah, we have 4 years of data prior to any delay.
Mm-hmm.
And then during that portion of the experiment, there was 2 years of the experimental delay in those three counties and no delay in the two adjacent counties to the north. And then in 2023, all counties experienced the two-week delay. So that means we have 3 years of treatment data in those three counties where they were delayed and 1 year of delay in the two adjacent northern counties.
Okay, so I'm hoping next is you're going to tell me a turkey population's quadrupled in those three counties, and we have found the solve for the wild turkey decline in the United States.
Well, yeah, that was the hope. We were looking for the silver bullet, but it had a little tarnish on it. You know, the interesting thing about this is, you know, this is really good science.
Yeah.
And we've got large sample sizes, excellent experimental design for wildlife studies especially, and we've got important results. And so we're really lucky to have be set up this way through the commission's efforts and be able to answer this question. And so we've got all this data. And so we're measuring seven different vital rates. And a vital rate is something like the percentage of hens that attempt a nest. So that's one of them, one of the seven.
Yeah.
There's other things like hatchability, nest success, how often they re-net, do the poults survive, the timing of it. So there's a bunch of different ways of looking at this. And we've looked at it literally every which way. But from a global population point of view, there's only three things you need to keep in mind to know what your population is doing in general. First of all, the nest success rate. You know, when they attempt a nest, how successful are they? Then you have to look at poult survival. Importantly, if your nest hatches out, do the poults live? And how long do they live? Do they make it into the next breeding population a year from now? And then Third, you've got to look at hen survival. You know, how are your hens doing and how are they surviving on the annual cycle? And so when we looked at those, all seven parameters, but especially those three parameters, and you look at them year by year, because every year is a new possibility, what we found was that in 5 out of the 6 years, not counting 2023, 5 out of the 6, the numbers didn't add up. Basically, the survival rates for nests and poults and hens were too low simultaneously to sustain those populations. And then 2018 was a good year where everything lined up and we actually had probably a population that was growing again. And you know, this is not atypical for upland game bird species. It's a boom or bust cycle where they have a tremendous clutch size, they can re-nest, you know, they can put a lot of birds on the ground. And so when they get it right, you know, they have the opportunity to build that population back. But when we looked at it across our whole study, the majority of the time, they didn't get it right. And the population, based on those inputs, was in a state of decline in 5 out of the 6 years. And the rate of decline was somewhere between 10 and 20%. So,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't just down 1 or 2%, you know, being almost stable. They were actually well below what we needed for a stable population. So we didn't find the silver bullet in terms of the 2-week delay, but we did clearly document what the population is doing. It's not doing very well. And we also documented what the basis for that was based on the vital rate. The nest, poult, and hen survival rates simultaneously are too low.
Mm. And was there between the three counties that got the 2-year delay versus the other two that did not, that border it? So, I mean, you're talking very similar habitat, I would assume. Was there any difference in the rates?
Do you want to jump in, Craig, and further explain the 2-week delay?
Number one, there was a lot of variation. Okay, so whether it be nest success, hen survival, poult survival, et cetera, you know, there's a lot of variation from year to year.
Mm-hmm.
And some years it's better than others, as Dave explained. But when we analyzed all of the data, very interestingly to me, none of those eight reproductive parameters or vital rates, and I'm saying eight because I'm including fecundity, which is the number of poults that ultimately survive into the fall population. There was no difference between the control counties and the treatment counties. So we were unable to detect a difference as a result of the delay, which to me was quite enlightening. And let me go ahead and say, we are not saying that a delay in the start of the hunting season cannot make a difference. You know, for example, if we open the Tennessee hunting season on March 15th, I would fully expect there would be problems associated with that, but that's not the case. And so in other states that may be implementing or considering implementing a delay, they need, of course, to look at when the birds are nesting, the timing of the reproductive period, of course, largely driven by photo period, and it varies considerably by latitude. But for example, in Tennessee, as narrow top to bottom the state is, there's only about 2 minutes difference of daylight between the northern border with Kentucky and the southern border with Alabama or Mississippi. And across the state, of course, there's no difference. And so we're not going to see a differing nesting period from north to south or east to west in Tennessee. But of course, if you go from New York to Florida, you're going to see a lot of difference. And so each of these states need to look at the timing of their reproduction, which they have and they are, and then adjust the season to that. And so I know there are a number of states that are considering delays, and some of them have contacted me and asked me my opinion. And I said, look, I can't tell you whether you should or should not implement a delay. All I can do is relate to the data that we've collected in Tennessee. And in a biological context, what it has shown us is that when we open the season in early April and we compare that to opening the season in mid-April, we did not see a difference in the reproductive rates or productivity. And what that means is when we open the season just prior to peak nest initiation, it was not different than when we opened the season just prior to the peak of peak incubation. So, you know, nests are being started around April the 7th to April the 9th in Tennessee. So that's peak nest initiation. And then peak nest incubation initiation is around, and it varies, but around April the 25th. So when we open the season just prior to peak nest initiation and compare that to opening the season just prior to peak nest incubation initiation, we didn't see a difference.
Yeah. So, I mean, that could be very useful information, I think, for other states, because they probably know those dates of initiation versus incubation, which in layman's terms means when the hen starts putting her eggs down, but she's not going to start incubating those till she has, you know, all 12 or so eggs out. So that takes her about 12 days, I assume.
Well, you know, what's interesting, to my knowledge, this is the only study that has compared these vital rates with the timing of the hunting season. And it has long been assumed that to be most conservative, you would open the hunting season sometime around when incubation is at least starting to peak. And so obviously that would tell you that the birds have reproduced and the hens are on the nest. And that is a logical assumption. And so it was very interesting for us to have the ability to test that and look at it and see if there was an effect. And we did not find one.
Yeah. I mean, has anyone looked to see in turkey nests that don't hatch, or, you know, maybe something like that, where the eggs just aren't being fertilized by a gobbler? Like, I mean, is that a problem at all in your mind? Is that the hens are not even being bred because we are killing them? We're killing the males, so the hen does not have a gobbler.
Yeah, and so Dave can chime in here, but to me, the two of the biggest results we found was the percentage of hens that nested, the nesting rate, was not different. And the hatchability of the eggs was not different. And both of those were relatively high. And so, you know, when you have 80-some% of the hens nesting, and that varied some by year, of course, and 80-some% of the eggs hatching, 80-some% of the hens nesting and 80-some% of the eggs hatching, that's good. Those are good numbers, and you can see that in many different areas. And we simply didn't see any difference between the counties that were delayed versus the ones that were not delayed. I mean, if there were, we would be shouting from the rooftop, hey, we need to open the season on April the 15th. But, you know, it's just not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, you know, Cameron, as an added point on that, Dr. Rick Gerhold with the UT Vet School is working with TWRA and a bunch of other state agencies to actually evaluate the fertility rates in turkey eggs. And I know last year, you know, what happens is if any of the state agencies or their cooperators find a nest that's hatched and there's an egg left over or a nest that's been abandoned, they collect the eggs and they ship them to UT. And then Dr. Gerhold's students evaluate the fertility. And based on their preliminary results from last year, anyway, of 400 some eggs, he said, you know, just somewhat anecdotally, he said, we haven't found any evidence of a problem with fertility, meaning that the fertilization rates were as high as expected across the whole bunch of states where they were collecting eggs. And, you know, when you think about it, when you're collecting eggs that didn't hatch out of a nest or eggs that, you know, from an abandoned nest, that would kind of be the worst case scenario for potential problems. And the fact that they didn't find in the first year of the study any strong issue with that sample, to me, suggests that the fertility issue is probably not going to be, you know, the silver bullet that we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
No, the fertility is not influencing 75-80% of the nest being eaten. There's your problem.
So it doesn't matter if it's look at
any study across the Southeast, and nest success is relatively low. It varies by studies, but relatively low. And we were averaging across sites somewhere in the mid 20s, and some years and some areas would bump up, and it differed some by which vegetation types the birds were nesting in, but the greatest nest success occurred in early successional communities, you know, such as old fields, and in, you know, for example, some of the stands, the forest stands that had been harvested within the first year or two, maybe three after harvest in those young forest conditions, when the birds would nest in there, we were averaging somewhere in the upper 30s with regard to nest success. And still, that's low. You know, 30 years ago in Tennessee, at least one study that was done and published in 1988, they recorded 62% nest success. And so, you know, when you're talking about nest success in the 20s and 30s, you know, percentage, that's the problem. I mean,
yeah. And you're saying that's the better ones.
Animals are eating turkey at alarming rates and their egg. And simply put, that's limiting their productivity, period.
So
any way to know what, you know, are we losing more hens sitting? Or are we losing more nests and not as many hens?
So I think the answer to that is yes. So that kind of surprised me from monitoring all these hens is that a pretty good number of hens actually get whacked on the nest or in association with their brood. And, you know, when we spend all this effort getting a hen radio tagged and following her, finding her nest, monitoring her nest, she hatches it out. We might radio take a couple of poles. You know, we've got a tremendous investment in that particular hen. And then she gets whacked along with the whole brood on day two after hatching. It's like, holy, you know, holy crap. You know, this is not good. But But the interesting thing is we calculated hen survival during the nesting season, and it's lower than during the rest of the season. So, you know, they nest for 3 months, May, June, July, basically. But then they're trying to survive the following 9 months, and their, you know, weekly nest survival rates are lower during the nesting season than they are during the whole rest of the year on a weekly basis. And what that suggests is that just the fact of the act of nesting makes them more vulnerable, either sitting on the nest or taking care of their brood and not being as wary about potential predators.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, because this is a very hot topic in the turkey world, based on what you just said. Can landowners help turkeys by removing predators, in your opinion, or y'all's opinion?
And my opinion is absolutely. I work with a lot of landowners on a yearly basis, and especially on the larger properties. Obviously, you can have a much, much bigger impact on, you know, a property that's, you know, 2,000 to 5,000 acres or whatever than you can on a property that's, you know, 20 to 50 acres. And of course, that's an issue. But on those properties where the landowners are implementing first proper habitat management and providing the needs that turkeys have, providing the resources that turkeys need, whether it be, you know, nesting cover, brooding cover, various food resources, managing roost, et cetera, and then coupling that with some level of predator control. And it might be as simple as cage traps and dog proofs for nest predators. And it might also include trapping for coyotes and bobcats, obviously some of the main predators on adult birds. Those properties have good numbers of birds, just very generally speaking, but that's the way it is. And so what I tell people is, look, you can't fix everything, but you can improve things. And so if you're managing your property for turkeys, no matter how large, how small, try to provide what turkeys need, and obviously the cover and food resources that they need, and trap some nest predators prior to nesting season. You are likely to help them. I wish I could give you, you know, a percentage increase that you could expect, but we were not able to do that. That's one thing that that we have been trying to do, is set up a project for that. But I wholeheartedly believe that people can improve the situation, and I say situation, for turkeys on their property, because, you know, not just habitat, that should come first, very clearly, but also implement some level of predator control.
Okay.
Think about the predators. Think about the predators 30 years ago. Obviously not as many coyotes, hardly any, if any, armadillos, even in, you know, South Middle Tennessee. It wasn't until the 1980s that the relocation program for raccoons ended in Tennessee. And I remember riding around in the late 90s with a colleague, Billy Menzer, and we would be logging every dead raccoon that we saw along the road to report that, hey, you know, they've expanded into this area, and they've expanded into this area. And, you know, lo and behold, 25 years later, you know what? It worked.
And people really wish y'all wouldn't have done that project.
people are putting corn out all over the place. And, you know, it's not uncommon to have at least 8 or 12 coons in a trail camera picture over a feeder. And so it shouldn't be surprising that we have issues with turkey productivity. It's kind of a perfect storm. And you know, I believe there's certainly landscape effects. Our landscape is very different than it was 30 years ago. I mean, the human population has continued to rise in a huge way. And look at all of the infrastructure that comes about as a result of that. More and bigger roads, more buildings, more subdivisions, et cetera, et cetera. And the property sizes now are much smaller than they were. And so the land is not being managed the same. The vegetation overall, in a general sense, is becoming more dense, you know, for fields that are no longer maintained or farmed, and they've become, you know, dense woods. and the smaller property sizes, we have set up a condition that is very favorable to the predators and not as favorable to the turkeys. And, you know, the bottom line is turkeys don't have as much of an area or place to live as they did 30 years ago because of all of the human development. And so when you put all these things together, personally, I don't think it's surprising that we have seen populations either stop growing or in many areas begun to decline.
Yeah. One thing you didn't mention there in part of this decline talk is disease. Did y'all test your turkeys that you were trapping for different diseases? A lot of people that I've heard, you know, like there's got to be some massive disease because it's everywhere. Every state's seeing declines. You know, what did y'all see any evidence of any type of disease being a factor or any other factors besides predation and habitat loss slash changing habitat?
Yeah, you know, as part of our study, Dr. Rick Gerholt, the UT vet school research scientist and vet, he's been part of the team and he's done the disease surveillance. And our study was one of the first to actually have a really, really broad-based surveillance strategy to look for every possible turkey disease that could be out there, including the possible effects from spreading chicken litter. There was a big concern when we first started the project that chicken houses down along the Alabama-Tennessee border in southern Middle Tennessee were basically producing disease-infested litter. And then when farmers spread it out in the fields, wild turkeys and other wildlife were being exposed to that. And so we went in, you know, wanting to look at the chicken litter issue and also to look at all other possibilities. And we, every time we trapped a bird, we took blood and fecal samples and also looked for other signs of disease. And then whenever birds were recovered, you know, from any reason, like if it was a roadkill bird or somebody found a stick bird on their front lawn or a hunter harvested bird or birds that died from predation, we would take the carcass and Rick, PhD student Lauren Horton would do necropsies on the carcass and actually look at the various organs and tissues and tests for all the common turkey diseases that you could imagine. And what they found was that these birds out there are exposed to the typical diseases that turkeys, you know, should be exposed to in that setting, but they didn't find any sign that clinical infections or, you know, disease outbreaks were tied to the population decline. So that's an important result that, you know, these birds are susceptible to disease. There's no doubt about that. And there are diseases out, you know, in the landscape, but they are not providing a population limiting factor for the birds that we've been studying. You know, it's not to say that if you get like avian influenza in a chicken house and then it spreads out to a wild turkey flock, you know, you could have serious problems. But mm-hmm. in our case, we didn't find any avian influenza at all. And the other turkey-based diseases we did find, the actual levels of infection were at like 1-2% of the samples or something like that. So there was very low. So that was actually good news that there, at least in our study, there isn't a single disease or set of diseases that is having a significant population level effect on turkeys.
Yeah. So did y'all survey, I guess, back to the delay, because Tennessee's had one season of a delay. We're about to start our second one in what feels like June as the trees have had leaves on for a month and, you know, they're definitely all gobbled out, so I would encourage all the other hunters to make sure to go crappie fishing this spring because the turkeys are done. But what are the masses in Tennessee as far as hunters? It sounded like y'all did some surveying. You know, from my opinion, I didn't mind it. I didn't really think it was all that great having the delay last year. You know, it does kind of feel weird waiting that extra 2 weeks. My opinion was if the bag limit's 2, it doesn't really matter, you know, not pridefully. I may never kill another turkey again, but if statistics play out, I probably was going to be able to get my 2 birds between April 15th and the end of May when the season ended. But what are other hunters think of this delay? Is it mostly negative feedback?
Well, in our surveys, and we surveyed hunters in that five-county area every year of the study. And for 7 years, we had a mail-out survey, and then in 2023, we had an online survey with about 10,000 hunters that we contacted. But the bottom line is, number one, let me say, turkey hunters are willing to do, you know, about whatever they need to do, whether it's moving the season, delaying the bag limit, whatever the case may be, to try and help turkeys and have more birds. That's number one. And so they had mixed opinions on the two-week delay because many were under the impression that by delaying the season, it was going to fix things.
Yeah.
But the majority of them did not want the delay. They wanted the season to open in early April, especially if the results of the study indicated that the delay was not helping things. And so it was, I can't remember exactly, like in the upper 60s or 70% or whatever that said that they wanted it opened in early April, especially if there is no effect of the delay. There's several interesting things. You know, the efficiency of hunters generally improved with the delay because they didn't spend as much time hunting to kill a bird. But that, of course, is in part because during that experimental delay, the season was shortened by 2 weeks. And so they had, you know, fewer numbers of days to actually hunt. But as Dave mentioned earlier, only 50% of the hunters killed a bird, and that it doesn't matter if it's control counties, treatment counties before the delay or after the delay, that remained true. And hunters did not kill more or fewer birds. They killed the same number of birds, regardless of the counties or the delay or no delay. So that was
Craig, also regardless of the bag limit.
Yeah,
that's correct. You know, we were in a period when the bag limit was 4, and then it went to 3, and then it went to 2, and the hunters that we surveyed killed the same number of birds regardless of the bag limit. And also, interestingly, the statewide harvest has remained the same, you know, on average, regardless of the bag limit. So, you know, those are all very interesting results, I believe.
Yeah. So have we seen an increase, in hunters? Do you think we have more hunters or about stable, or do you know?
We had an increase in hunters in 2020 during the virus year. And, you know, people were afraid that we were going to kill too many birds because people had more time on their hands, et cetera. But what our surveys indicated was that the hunters did not kill more birds. However, there were more new hunters that came into the ranks, and there were more returning hunters. You know, for example, they might not have hunted for 5 years, but they hunted in 2020. And the percentages of the new or returning hunters mirrored the increase in the harvest that year. So Lindsay Phillips led a paper she's published on the effects of COVID during 2020. It's very interesting, but yeah, all that's highlighted in that paper.
So overall, most hunters, which is pretty much, I guess, would be my opinion now that I think about it, is like, if this study shows that it doesn't help anything, then yeah, I'd rather hunt them in early April. It sounds like that's kind of the most
goblin, of course, because I don't know. Maybe Dave, you want to tell them about the ARUs?
Yeah, you know, we've got acoustic recording units, tape recorders, basically spread out across the whole state, north to south and east to west. So we're documenting all the gobbling phrenology, and the peak in gobbling across the state is about April 1st. And then there's a secondary peak around April 15th, a lower peak, but recognizable. And surely that first peak is when the gobblers are with all those hens, you know, they're roosting together and they're all, you know, going crazy. But then when the hens start to break up early in April, you get that secondary peak when incubation starts and individual gobblers are, you know, really trolling hard to find, you know, a hen that might be receptive. So all that gobbling's going on in the first 2 weeks of April. Of course, it's going on in March also, but the first 2 weeks of April are when it's peaking. And then it's just declining steadily from there. But by May 15th, the gobbling's done. And then the last 2 weeks in May, which now is the last 2 weeks of the season, you know, you can find a bird that'll gobble. And I'm sure if a hen fails and she starts walking around and, you know, looking for a new nest site, a gobbler will probably find her and start gobbling again. But generally, the last 2 weeks of the season, there's, you know, practically no gobbling at all. So when I think about, you know, what a hunter would prefer, and of course, you know, Craig and I have only collectively turkey hunted for 65 years. So we have a couple of years of experience on the ground. But nevertheless, ask a hunter, would you rather trade the first 2 weeks of April with peak gobbling for the last 2 weeks of May with no gobbling? And I can guarantee you the response would be 100%. I want the gobbling because, you know, just hearing a bird gobble is linked to the satisfaction of hunting, of turkey hunting. And, you know yourself, if you go out there and you don't hear anything, you know, you can troll and you might stumble upon a bird, but you want to hear that bird gobble. So, you know, there's a clear preference for the first 2 weeks in April compared to the last 2 weeks of May.
Yeah. And I think, Craig, you said it really well of like, turkey hunters want to do what helps make more turkeys. So I think like had this study shown, yeah, we produced five times as many poults or heck, even 10% more poults in delay than we did without the delay. I think most hunters would be like, hey, you know what? I'm okay with delaying it then. We're going to have more birds. But if that's not the case, why punish ourselves for taking like the better part of our hunting season away if it's not going to make a difference?
Right. If it made a difference, we would be shouting it from the rooftop. And to be honest, we thought, you know, this is a very plausible idea. We don't know if the Tennessee season is starting too early or not. So this should be very interesting to see. And we simply didn't see an effect.
Yeah. So what about last year? You know, we had statewide. The, you know, a critic might say, well, you only studied three counties, which that's still a humongous landscape. Statewide, the whole state was delayed. And from my personal experience, I saw less poults last year than I did the two previous years. What was the overall effect of that? Did we produce more poults last year with the delay?
Your observations mirror our data because last year, 2023, when, you know, the two-week delay had been implemented statewide, that was on average our lowest year in terms of nest success across all the counties. And so average nest success last year was at or just below 20%. And so it went down and you know, where we were averaging in, you know, the mid 20s and in some years on up into the 30s, last year was low.
Wow. So yet again, the silver bullet's not quite shining too well there. And I guess you'll have data again this year. Are y'all still collecting data?
Yes.
We're still doing the predator camera study, and we're still monitoring some hens. So we've got cameras in association with nests, not at the nest because we don't want to attract predators, but near the nest. And we have cameras out in the landscape, and we're just documenting the predator communities, mammalian predator communities that are out there. And we're looking at whether they are linked to successful or unsuccessful nests. So we're still doing baseline monitoring on the predator community.
Yeah. A lot of people with the early green up this year, you know, early spring's kind of a thing. Are turkeys just right on time, just like every other year, about the same timing with the nest initiation and everything? I would assume it's about the same.
Yeah, and interestingly, a study in North Carolina led by Chris Mormon, it was very interesting. At NC State, they had lots of study sites from the coast to the mountains, and I think some of their sites in the mountains were up above 4,000 feet. And so they had a tremendous variation in elevation and weather. And from what Chris has told me, their nest cycle and gobbling chronology was precisely the same from east to west, which makes sense because we've long known that day length, the photo period, is what drives the reproduction. And so the amount of day length from Wilmington, North Carolina, to Asheville, North Carolina, is the same.
Yeah. So the warm weather and rain, sun, none of that matters, is what I'm hearing.
Well, I'm not saying none of that matters. It can matter to vary at least by, you know, a few days or whatever, but it's not
a month
factor.
Yeah, it's not going to vary it by like 3 weeks where hunters totally right. missed the breeding season because, you know, it greened up early.
Right.
Yeah.
Same way with deer. You know, you get in a hot November, deer are going to breed, whether it's hot or whether it's cold. It can vary a little bit, but it's not going to be a month difference for sure.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is the delay wasn't the silver bullet that we hoped it would be. I wish it was that easy, honestly. That would have been way easier than habitat improvement and predator management. Just hold the gun off for 2 weeks and have tons of turkeys.
But,
that'd be one.
But do you know what, Cameron? It wouldn't be as fun. You know, it's fun to get out there and burn your woods. It's fun to get out there and disc a field to improve the brooding cover. It's fun to get on a tractor or a four-wheeler and get out and spray plants that shouldn't be there, that do yep. not help turkeys in any way. I mean, that's part of it. And I hope more people will get into that. And let me quickly mention this. You know, something else that we detected that was very surprising to me was, and we're not done with this. We're still analyzing the brood data, but only, and this is preliminary from rough, you know, some figures, only about 15% of our brood locations were in fields. And, you know, fields are widely wow. regarded as, you know, the quote, best brooding cover. But when you get out and you look at the condition of these fields and what it's like at ground level, there's no wonder. You know, at one of the WMAs, in the first year, we had several nests, and all of the hens that nested there went more than a mile away before they settled into brood cover, you know, after, you know, 2 to 3 days after hatching. And I thought, man, you know, that's a long way. And so I went out there and took a look at the area where they were nesting on this WMA, and I thought, well, no wonder. Look at the conditions. It's so thick with grass and other vegetation at the ground level that there's no way a 2 or 3 day old poult could navigate through this. And so we implemented various practices to improve the vegetation and the vegetation composition and the structure of vegetation. And then they began seeing hens with broods in those fields. And so absolutely, you can make a difference on your property, both from a habitat standpoint, but also from a survival standpoint by doing something to help increase their survival by killing a few of the animals that are putting so much pressure on them.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's over a mile. That's pretty impressive walk for a day-old poult.
Well, it might have taken 2 or 3 days before they got there. But, you know, my question why isn't she just going, you know, 300 yards away or whatever from the nest and setting up, you know, or begin using an area there? I mean, they don't just set up and use one small area. They keep on roaming, and they will roam over a large area. But just to leave the nest site and go that far away. And as Dave mentioned, when they're having to move through what should be considered a hostile environment, you know, you're talking about woods that are wide open with no vegetation whatsoever, and you're surprised they're eaten by raptors or, you know, what have you. It shouldn't be surprising.
Yeah. Well,
is there anything to, and in my feeble little mind, it seems like it makes sense. And I'm going to add on to that before I get to the question. And I don't see that last week or 2 weeks of season being a hot time for gobblers gobbling and being lonely and looking for love. But is there something to this, I guess, phenomenon of all of the hens not going to nest on or about the same time, and those nests, that incubation time being spread out over a longer period of time, and that making it easier for predators to destroy those nests?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's something we looked at. And before and after the delay, and looking at the delay counties and the no delay counties, there was no change whatsoever in nesting season length. And that holds true whether we look at the initial nest season only or the entire nesting season that included all of the re-nest. The numbers were virtually the exact same. And there was no shift, no contraction, which, you know, that's one of the things that you would expect. If all of them were being bred at the same time and earlier, the nesting season would contract. And that did not happen at all. And in fact, the nesting season in the delayed counties after the delay was actually, you know, like a few days longer than before. So there was no contraction of the nesting season.
Yeah. And, you know, I think back to when I first started turkey hunting 30 years ago, that last 10 days of season in Alabama, gobblers would be falling all over themselves to come to you. And it now it's not unusual. And now today season's been pushed back a week into May, and it's not unusual at the end of May to see a gobbler with two or three hens in the middle of the day.
Just re-nests, maybe?
Yeah, you know, that's you know, we tracked re-nesting, and you know, those re-nest attempts can begin as quickly as like 7 to 10 days. So if you had a nest that failed in the middle of April, they could be nesting again by, you know, the first week or second week in May. And so, you know, those gobblers that are left out there, they're still trolling, looking for hens. But I'm sure their overall activity levels from a huntability point of view have gone down. You know, it's if it was easy pickings at the end of the season, there would be a lot of people out there during the end of the season, I think.
Yeah.
And another thing, yes, we did see some birds re-nesting within about a week, but there were also birds that did not re-nest until it was 50-some days after their initial nest had been either depredated or abandoned. And so there is a wide variation in the amount of time between an initial nest being depredated or abandoned and the onset of re-nesting. There's a lot of variation there. Not all of them at all begin re-nesting that soon after the initial nest is either torn up or abandoned.
And this may be the dumbest thing you've ever heard, but I thought, does a hen who has failed her nest, I don't even know if y'all know this, does she have to find a gobbler to breed with in order to make another nest? I thought they had like a way of storing sperm.
Yes, in the literature, it reports that, and it's somewhat old literature, but it reports that viable sperm may be retained for up to like 56 days. And so to answer your question, no, but also it's more likely to see, of course, smaller clutch sizes, and you may see fewer eggs that hatch in re-nest, but that sperm is retained and she doesn't necessarily have to mate again in order to lay another clutch of eggs.
Wow. But would you assume, like, if a hen was, do you think they try to seek out a gobbler?
I would think so, yes.
Okay. I mean,
I would think that she would likely breed again.
Yeah, if she could. So, because, yeah, I mean, in my opinion, like, late season turkey hunting anywhere, it's a game of, like, there's a lot less turkeys, bunch of them been shot. But if you find one that's ready, he's usually really ready.
I don't disagree with that at all.
Yeah. So next week, the commission will vote on next season, 2025's turkey seasons and bag limits and the structure. And I think there's some quotas going on WMAs and, you know, all the regulations surrounding our turkey season next year. And from what I gathered from a slideshow presentation to them last month, I guess, is that TWRA is recommending 6 different turkey zones and 3 different models, conservative, moderate, and aggressive, for season length and bag limit. You know, moderate being a like one bird limit with a 4-week season, moderates 2 birds in 5 weeks, and aggressives 3 birds in 6 weeks. And it would basically, per unit through the 6 different zones, it would tell you whether, based on a bunch of variables, pulp production, agriculture, all this stuff, which model you should implement for your season dates on that zone. Is that correct, what I just said, I guess?
From what I understand, yes.
Okay. Based on what y'all have seen after studying these turkeys in Tennessee for 7 years or 8 years, however many it is on this massive study, what do you think, what would you recommend the season bag limit, you know, those factors be going forward for Tennessee?
Well, when we look at our data and we think about the reproduction that we recorded and harvest rate and the differences of bag limits and whatever, and think about when the experimental delay was implemented, which in 2021 and 2022, it was April the 2nd and April the 3rd. We believe that an opening date on the first Saturday in April is sound. And that then, of course, would allow a rotating opening date from April the 1st to April the 7th. And that centers on that April 2nd and 3rd dates in which those data were collected. That differs from the traditional opening season date, which since 1986 until it was changed was the first Saturday in April. And so then the season might open on March 27th or 28th. And
that was the Saturday closest to April 1st, right?
That's correct. Isn't okay. That what I said?
Oh, you said first Saturday in April, I think.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I meant the traditional opening date was the Saturday closest to April 1st, which means the season could open, you know, March 27 or 28. And that is not when we collected the data. And so we are not proposing to go back to that. But yeah, by having the season open the first Saturday in April, that, you know, on average about 4 or 5 days later, delayed, yeah, if you will, from that traditional opening day. So that's somewhat of a conservative recommendation, which we believe is sound based on the data that we've collected and when the experimental delay opened. And I think it's a good compromise between those who would like to see the season open in late March to those who would like to see it open, you know, in mid-April. And our data indicate that there's no issues with that. Mm-hmm. So I think that first Saturday in April would be biologically sound. And because of the goblin chronology, we think it would be prudent to limit the season to 5 weeks. You know, once you get into mid-May, the goblin really drops off. And, you know, 5 weeks is sufficient time for people to get out and turkey hunt. And because the statewide harvest remains essentially the same, whether the bag limit was 4 or 3 or 2, we believe that it could be increased to 3, but we also believe that any bird killed in the fall, you know, we have a fall season where males are legal, and in those counties where you can fall turkey hunt, the limit is 1 per county. And I strongly believe that should be changed. Any bird that is killed in the fall, I think, should be included in the annual statewide bag limit. And so if there was an annual statewide bag limit of 3, then you could kill 1 in certain counties in the fall, and then you would be able to kill 2 in spring. I think that's a sensible approach. And the other thing is, you know, number one, you can kill too many gobblers. And, you know, there's population work that has shown, and it's been promoted for many years, that if you kill, you know, approximately 30% of the gobblers, then you're able to sustain the population, but it's cautioned to not go above that. And mm-hmm. if you kill more than 25% of the adult gobblers, then you are likely going to reduce the age structure of the male population. And so, you know, private landowners have a responsibility there to survey their property and try to get an idea of how many adult males there are and be prudent in how many birds they kill on the property. And likewise, of course, the state agencies have to monitor and regulate the hunting pressure on WMAs. And, you know, it's not just the number of birds, but it's also the distribution of the hunting pressure. You know, on those WMAs where 80% of the birds are being killed on opening week, that's a problem. And so spreading that out, whether it be by, you know, quota permits or whatever, however they want to do it, it should be spread out. And personally, with regard to the number of jakes that are killed and with regard to recruiting more adult birds into the spring population, we've also proposed that jakes be illegal except for youth. And youth, in my opinion, should, you know, it's not a problem for youth to kill a jake, but I still think that should be limited to one. And that helps everybody with regard to helping recruit more adult birds into the spring population. And there's several things that could be done on WMAs to help spread some of the harvest out and provide additional opportunities to more hunters. And I think I should say, of course, it's not prudent for hens to be legal, and that includes bearded hens. I wish there was a regulation change that made bearded hens illegal, because that is the most important factor with regard to recruit more birds into the population. We have to have those productive hens out there as much as possible.
Yeah. So it would be interesting to know, if you increase the adult gobbler bag limit to 3, but restricted jakes and bearded hens, honestly feel like you would overall kill less turkeys.
You very well may. And I think that's fine.
Yeah. You know, and like, you're saving hens and young of the year. And yeah, I mean, in my opinion, that sounds better.
It's almost like common limit. Sense. It's almost like common sense. And I mean, think about deer, and of course, quality deer management now is, you know, like the standard of what most deer hunters do. They don't shoot young bucks. They wait until, you know, bucks get into older age classes, you know, let the turkeys live and get into an older age class and reduce the pressure on them a little bit. I think that would lead to better and more exciting turkey hunt.
Yeah.
Son, you know, when you think about it, you know, every time I see a group of jakes, you know, when I was a kid, I was always excited and I'd put the hammer down. But since I've matured, and I think this is true of many, many turkey hunters in Tennessee, as you mature, you realize that you're out there for the overall experience with a gobbler strutting and coming into your calling and everything else. But for every 2 jakes you see this year, that's a 2-year-old gobbler next year, because they have survival rates around 50%. And so if you think of it that way, that I'm not shooting a jake this year, I am stockpiling him to hunt him in all his glory next year. It just makes a lot of sense to me. And it's not like you can't stockpile them. The answer is yes, you can stockpile them from year to year, and you have about a 50% survival rate to carry it from this year to next year. So, you know, you stockpile 2, you'll be 1 ahead of the game next year.
Yeah. I mean, that to me makes a lot of sense. I believe the slideshow I watched, that the proposal given actually had them remove, like right now you can only kill 1 jake out of your 2 birds. And I think they actually had part of that was to remove it.
Yeah. I certainly applaud the agency for doing that, but I think we could go a step farther and limit jakes to only youth and only 1 per youth per year. And with these proposed regulations, we do not see that there is a need for regional regulations, you know, with a 5-week season, a 3-bird limit, that's relatively simple, straightforward, and biologically warranted. And personally, I believe I haven't surveyed them, but I think hunters would appreciate a little more simplicity to the turkey season. And certainly I think everybody would agree that including whatever they kill in the fall into an annual bag limit is quite sensible.
Yeah, I guess I'm one of the few people who fall turkey hunts, so I'd rather it not, but I'd be okay with it also. But
well, it's not saying you can't fall turkey hunt. It's just that, you know, that's helping meter the gobbler harvest over an annual basis.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I know the fall hunting is not a big tradition, I would say, in Tennessee, though. I mean, we kill like a couple hundred birds in fall. But yeah, I do. I get what you're saying.
There's not that many killed. No, the numbers I remember is somewhere around 500 to 600, but I don't have that in front of me.
That sounds about right.
Certainly a whole lot more jakes are killed than fall birds, no doubt.
Yeah, I think if you got rid of jakes and bearded hens, you save a lot more turkeys into the population than you do with the fall, or keeping it even at a two-bird limit. I think going to three with jake restriction and bearded hen makes a lot of sense, but... what I was saying is I think the proposal I saw on that slideshow was they wanted to reinstate that you could just fill your whole limit with jakes. Like, even though they went back to only one of them could be a jake, they were just going to remove that. And I was like, that seems to be going backwards. But yeah, anyway.
I do not know that.
Yeah, that was part of the proposal.
Okay.
I can send you.
Quick question, and I think I know the answer, but what if – for every two jakes we see, one of those birds is going to be a two-year-old next year. What's the number one predator of that jake?
Likely coyotes and bobcats here.
Okay. So it's not hunting.
And hunters.
It's not hunters.
Well, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about, quote, natural predators.
If you let him walk, I guess, then yeah.
But, Dave, you've probably run the numbers. I would... certainly there is. I don't have the numbers in terms of how many jakes are killed in front of me. I remember just a few years ago when the bag limit was three, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of, as I remember, 6,000 to 7,000, something like that. So there's, you know, a fair amount of harvest of jakes, but the primary natural predators, of course, would be coyotes and bobcats.
Sure.
Yeah, I think we looked at the percentage of the harvest in our five focal counties that was made up of jakes, and it was like 7 to 10% or something like that. It was a little higher than what I would have thought, but nevertheless, that still is. So if it at 7 to 10% of the total harvest is made up of jakes, but that doesn't tell you what percentage of the jakes are being harvested. And in our study, you know, we radio tagged jakes, and of course, you know, we were on 382 separate private farms and three WMAs. So, I mean, you know, we were on lots of different properties that had whole bunches of different hunting strategies. But we generally saw a pretty small percentage of the jakes that we radio tagged actually being harvested out there. So I would say harvest would not be, you know, that significant of a contributor to jake survival. I think coyotes and bobcats, I'd agree with Craig, are definitely the number one and number two factors affecting jake survival.
Interesting. Okay.
So that's the proposal and that y'all have sent, correct, to the commission based on your study, is three bird limit, 5-week season, start first Saturday in April. No jakes other than youth can kill one, and no bearded hens. Include the fall bag in your annual bag. Does that sound like a quick summary?
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, I want to acknowledge, you know, that we got support from TWRA and the Wildlife Commission for the last 7 years, you know, tremendous support to pull this study together and to generate these data that we could make decisions on or they can make decisions on. And of course, you know, our recommendations are based on our understanding of the biology and our sense in surveying hunters of, you know, what the most sensible approach might be. And, you know, there's some differences between what the agency is proposing and what we're proposing. And that's, you know, that's healthy in the sense because the commission is going to weigh the hunter and they're going to weigh the birds and everything else and then make, you know, what they think the best decision is. And so what we're trying to do is not, you know, necessarily compete with an agency proposal. We're trying to just take our best shot at what we think makes the most sense so that the commission kind of has this full range of options to consider. And then the other thing I wanted to mention, well, before I forget, National Wild Turkey Federation and Turkeys for Tomorrow have both supported this project. The Turkey Federation for many years and Turkeys for Tomorrow for the last couple of years. And we really appreciate their help in supporting the project and making it all possible. And so this report, the summary report that we have pulled together most recently, has gone to the agency, and it's also gone to those two turkey groups because they're project sponsors. The report will be available to the general public when we finish a kind of a public version of it in the next week or two. So it'll be available probably through the UT website or maybe even through, you know, agency or Turkey Federation or Turkeys for Tomorrow websites.
Yeah. Dave, that was very well put. I appreciate you saying that so people are not confused. We most definitely are not trying to compete or recommend against anything the agency is recommending. It's simply that in our contract, we were asked to provide recommendations. So we are providing TWRA what they asked us to provide at the conclusion of the study. And other than a couple of relatively small parts, you know, as Dave mentioned with the predator work and also some habitat work, the other portions are largely complete. And so we're simply trying to provide them what they asked for. And the other people, of course, that we definitely need to mention are the graduate students. You know, this was a large project, and it has entailed three master's students, Vinnie Johnson, Joe Quayle, and Casey Swafford, and also a PhD student, Lindsay Phillips. And they have done a fantastic job collecting and analyzing the data, super hard work and so many hours put into it. And obviously none of this would be possible without them.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Those students work hard on it, no doubt. And we appreciate y'all for doing this work and the agency and these organizations, NWTF and TFT, for supporting y'all. And in my opinion, I think this is a very important and timely study because that was a big question that's been going around. And I don't know how you study it much better than what y'all did.
Well, you know, we don't find out answers unless somebody is willing to fund it. And Dave mentioned the funding sponsors, but primarily the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency. I mean, they stepped up and put up big money to do this. And there are not many state agencies who have done that. And it's only because of that commitment that we have been able to find out the information that we have. So, you know, in all seriousness to the listeners, TWRA deserves a lot of credit and kudos for being willing to spend the money to collect data like we've been able to do.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you both for joining us on this show and giving us this very timely and great information. I know our listeners enjoyed that, and I did too. So thank you. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for doing the study. Thanks for what you do for turkeys.
Yeah, thank you, gentlemen.
Good to talk with you.
Good talking to you, too.
Good turkey on Saturday.
Yeah.
Thank you. Same to you guys. Y'all safe out there. Yeah. So what did you guys think about that one? That was pretty informative. And, you know, there's so many, and we learned this, Cameron, from our conversation with the two researchers that we met with last week. And that bonus content you were talking about before the interview, there's so many things that these researchers and these biologists look at, kind of stuff on the side that, you know, won't affect maybe bag limits, won't affect season dates, won't affect anything as far as game regs are concerned, but they're just curious.
Yes. Yeah.
We got to hear some of the things that Bueller and Harper looked at and were curious about, you know, some of those side things of, oh, I wonder if, and I found a lot of that interesting hearing that from them. And, but yeah, you know, this is all very interesting, you know, and you got to think at some point it truly makes sense.
Yeah.
There's no way that if you kill a gobbler, it does not affect the population. Just like if you kill a hen, it doesn't affect the population. But when does it matter? Does it matter if you shoot that bird in the fall or you shoot him after he's bred for a season.
Yeah.
You know, it's so you've taken him out of the equation. So there's been an effect on the population. Now, the struggle for these guys and the people on the conservation advisory boards or Department of Wildlife Resources, Game and Fish Commission, whatever they're called in your state. Once again, the problem is how do you balance that doing what's best for the game animal and hunter satisfaction?
Yep. Which it sounds like to me the conclusion for a lot of states could learn from this study is starting your season when nest initiation takes place is advisable because you get hunter satisfaction and it seems that starting it any later than that doesn't really help you is what they found, you know. So, and I mean, I get that. I guess nest initiation versus incubation. If she's initiating the nest, she's been bred. So,
yeah.
Anyway, it was an interesting study. It's very contrary to a lot of what we're hearing these days, because that's been a humongous question in the turkey space. Are we killing them too early? And their study shows that at least in Tennessee, based on starting it versus nest initiation versus nest incubation date, no effect.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean in other states aren't starting too early or too late or whatever. But for Tennessee, it seems pretty clear to me the evidence is showing that that's not the case. And, you know, the fact that we had the worst recruitment of the whole 8 years last year is not a good sign either.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. You know, I think maybe instead of our states fooling around with the start date of the season, assuming it starts around the time of nest initiation.
Yeah.
Or peak incubation, you know, whatever that's decided by the state. But instead of putting so much emphasis on the start date, maybe the states should really start to come up with some sort of plan to incentivize, or maybe it's not even incentivizing. Maybe it is promoting trapping predators, nest yeah. predators, and nesting just wild turkey predator. No, it yeah. doesn't
have to and, be nesting. And brooding and nesting habitat. I mean, the fact yeah. that the poults are monitoring had to walk a mile to get to brooding habitat. That's pitiful. No wonder none of them are making it. How many owls and hawks and coyotes and bobcats and raccoons do you think they have to pass in a mile?
A lot.
Yeah, so I am also very grateful to Dr. Harper for him and Dr. Grant Woods are the two guys, and I'm sure there's more, but in my mind, they're the two we've had on so far that are very confidently will tell you predator management is worth your time and effort.
Yeah.
And I believe in it. I'm seeing it on our own family farms, the impact that can be made. I am a strong believer in predator management. I do agree. Got to have good habitat. Now, granted, if you somehow could kill every predator, including avians, which you can't, you could raise a million turkeys on a football field, but not going to happen under you can't kill everything that kills turkeys. You never will, because we can't legally kill the avians.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to have good habitat to protect them. But I do think introducing that predator management on top of that is just the catalyst to have turkeys. I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate Dr. Harper and Bueller voicing that, because that's a big argument too right now. It's, you know, season delays, trapping doesn't work. And anyway,
I don't know about you, but Dr. Harper sounded very adamant and didn't hesitate in the least in that trapping predators absolutely 100% beyond the shadow of a doubt unequivocally helps wild turkey population.
Yep.
I mean, I don't know how he could have said that any more certain than he did on the show.
Yeah.
Interview. I mean,
I didn't realize how recent the raccoon restoration efforts were completed.
Like, yeah. Isn't that crazy?
I really wish that project had failed. Like that was wild. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure we have some raccoon hunters that love raccoon hunting, and not to slight y'all in any way, but I wonder what the state of things would be if we had not done that.
Yeah.
Probably would have helped. But anyway, that was an awesome interview. I hope y'all enjoyed it. I know I did. Learned a lot. And we really appreciate what they do. And, you know, you heard them at the end. Thank you to TWRA. Thank you to Turkeys for Tomorrow. Thank you to National Wild Turkey Federation. Without these organizations, this wouldn't have happened. And so we need them to help us answer these hard questions, because, you know, what if the study had gone the other way and it did increase poult production by 30%? That would have been a huge finding towards helping this thing out.
Absolutely.
And it's, in my opinion, it's a huge finding the other way. Now, why make hunters less satisfied when it doesn't matter? So we'll see what happens. You know, in 2 weeks, maybe I'll give an update on what actually gets voted into law, because this is all just their recommendation. So this is what they recommend. I think it sounds very, you know, fair based on their findings and their study. But ultimately, what the commission votes on, who knows? So I'll update everybody on how that kind of goes here in 2 weeks. But for now, this is what's been recommended to them from the University of Tennessee and the natural resources there. So,
yeah. Well, with all of that being said, I've got to say that now is the time for you guys listening to be trapping.
Oh, man. Big impact right now.
Trap your coyotes, your bobcats, assuming it's still legal in your state. Trap your raccoons, all of your nest predators, your skunks, your possums, armadillos if you can, pigs if you can. Trap them all. Everything is legal to trap. Trap them. And when you get through trapping and running that trap line, it's been a successful day out in the woods trapping, go hit the lake and do some crappie fishing to reward yourself.
Yeah. Yep. I like it, man. That sounds like a great thing for people to be doing. Both of those things, especially the crappie fishing. Make sure you're doing a lot of that this spring. Go listen to the Crappie Hunter podcast and enjoy doing that. But seriously, if you could trap right now, you know, time is a crunch, but ones you take out right now are very, you're hitting them at the right time. Well, heck, trap them with eggs. That just make you feel really good.
Yeah, no doubt. And most of us are in the woods more now. So now it just makes sense to trap right now, because we're in the woods almost every single day. Most of us are in the woods.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, if you go to hunting camp for 4 days,
yeah,
that first day, maybe midday, go put out a trap line and get 2 or 3 trap nights in, and you can walk past them while you're turkey hunting.
I can't tell you how many turkeys I've killed midday doing something other than walking in the woods trying to hunt turkeys.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, you know, there's this tree stand down here. I need to move it, you know, just get it out because the loggers are in that area. So I go in there and I start getting the ratchet strap off the tree stand, and it's going, in the distance. I mean, no joke. That truly happened to me about 20 something years ago. And so just go be out in the woods, run that trap line, get it all set up during the day and do it, man. I mean, take your kids with you too, because it's so enjoyable and educational for kids. So
Well, that in the favor of the week, I don't know what is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. All right. Well, I could keep rambling on about trapping forever, but that's not going to work. We're not going to do
deal.
So
There's your favor of the week. I like it.
Yeah.
You know? Good luck to everybody. A lot of states opening this weekend, whole lot of states, and more every weekend basically after this, and a lot are already open. So hunt safe. Last word from me. If you're baiting turkeys, please stop. I'm seeing more baiting this year by like tenfold than ever.
Yeah.
It's just a garbage way to turkey hunt. Go bait and shoot the robins off your bird feeder at home. It's the exact same experience. So stay away from the turkeys. Everyone else is out here trying to help them, and you're doing that.
Yeah. You know what bait is good for? Crappie.
Yeah. Go bait crappie. There you go. You can do that all day.
Oh, goodness.
Stay away from our turkeys. You just heard this podcast. They're declining pretty massively in areas. Everyone's trying to help them, and you sitting in your tent blind whacking them over a corn pile is not helping anything.
You know, like the guy we ran into last weekend, he has some seed out for his dove field.
Yeah, quote unquote.
He's got some sunflowers and some wheat and some milo for his dove field.
With the tent blind on it and the cellular trail camera and 3 long beards.
Watching doves. from his tip blind. I'm sure exactly what he's doing.
Yes, or the photo I got this morning from a hunting camp where there's a tent line and four bags of empty corn bags next to it.
Yeah. And Kroger, Publix, Walmart, Winn-Dixie, Safeway, you name it. They all sell frozen turkeys.
Yes, go buy those. Leave the wild ones alone. I know you can Photoshop an edit of you for the gram behind a turkey. I'll send you a picture. I'll take my face off of it if you need it. You can use that for the gram, and you can tell everybody what a great turkey hunter you are.
Hashtag tagged out, baby.
Yeah, you can be hashtag tagged out on your hashtag baiting49. But please, just stop. You're doing a lot more. I mean, you heard Craig Harper. Every turkey he kills basically got corn in his crop. Everybody's freaking baiting the turkeys and needs to stop. Wrap it up. There you go. Let me hop off my dead gum soapbox again.
Yeah. Go put your soapbox up. You're leaving to go on a trip. Go enjoy yourself.
Take a deep breath.
Maybe take a chill pill and a cold beer and relax a little bit. And with that, I'm going to say thank you guys so much for listening in this week. We know that you have choices. We appreciate you spending your time with us. We hope you have a wonderful week, and we look forward to seeing you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in. You were just listening to the Turkey Hunter Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please go on over to iTunes and leave a 5-star review. And make sure to head over to www.iamturkeyhunting.com to subscribe for free turkey hunting tips, tactics, strategies, and product reviews to help you have a more successful turkey season. And stay tuned for upcoming episodes on hunting afternoon birds, how to film your hunt, and the breeding cycle of hens, as well as some guest interviews. Thanks again for listening. We know your time is valuable, and we appreciate you sharing some of it with us. See you next week.